Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the psychoanalyst and author Darian Leader. Darian's the author of many successful books about the human mind, including The New Black, What is Madness, and his new one, Is It Ever Just Sex? That's right, we're going to talk a lot about sex on this episode. Darian is an expert who has a real down-to-earth clarity about the way he explains his ideas on the subject. Traditionally, shrinks seem to think that we are all carrying around mad, animalistic sexual desires that were only held back and controlled by society and good manners. But in his new book, Darian suggests there's far more to sex than simple physical desires, and he delves into the mental and emotional factors that surround what schoolboys of the 80s like me used to call having it off. There's some pretty wild stuff discussed in this episode, and I absolutely bloody love discussing it. I hope you enjoy listening. Darian, welcome to The Reset.
Hi, Sam. Good to meet you.
You're a Lacanian psychoanalyst, is that right?
So yeah, that's it.
Tell us a bit about what that means.
So Jacques Lacan was a French psychoanalyst and psychiatrist who was working from the sort of 1930s till the late 70s, early 80s. And what he did, he sort of reread Freud and other analysts and worked out a way of practicing and a way of thinking about how people manage, how people cope in their lives, how people manage to function, paying particular attention to language, how we're formed by what we hear as children, what we're told by our parents, what we overhear, what we read between the lines. And he thought the unconscious is largely made up of those things that are subliminally and sometimes much more directly transmitted to us. And so the work of analysis is in part trying to clarify what those messages are that we've received in our childhood and to try and reposition ourselves in relation to them. He also had a lot of, you know, quite complicated ideas about different kinds of ways in which people develop in their childhoods, how they relate to their parents, how there's very often a kind of unconscious masochism in people, that they're desperate to get rid of some aspect of their behavior that's troubling them or causes them suffering. But he thought that in many cases, not all, but many cases, there's a sort of unconscious satisfaction in the way that we suffer, and that's why we repeat things. And so he developed various ways to try to dislodge that, to rethink why we repeat things and to find ways around, you know, the sources of our suffering.
Why did that appeal to you?
Well, at the time, I went over to Paris to do my training. And before that, I did a lot of research in the different psychoanalytic traditions and different psychotherapy traditions. This was in the mid-1980s, and it seemed to me at the time the most scientific, the most robust way of working. It seemed that the most, really a way of thinking about human beings that recognize their complexity. And I know this is something that you're sensitive to in your own work and see it in the way you interview people, that you can't define people by one single aim. It's not that someone goes through life just wanting one thing, but we can want two totally incompatible things at the same time. That there's a lot of contradiction and complexity and conflict in human beings. Mm. And the Lacanian way seemed at the time to be a really good way of recognizing that, recognizing how complicated people are, how we want contradictory things at the same time, and how we can find a way out of that.
Your new book is called Is It Ever Just Sex? And which is a great title. We'll get on to why he called it that. But sex, when you talk about our old-fashioned or cliched ways in which, you know, psychoanalysts are portrayed, I said in my book, like, you know, before I ever went to therapy, probably my main fears when I knew nothing about it were that I would be sat on a couch and there are two things that I thought I'd be asked about: my parents and sex. And worst of all, the cliche is, oh no, they're going to try to establish that I fancy my mum. But, you know, I've heard you say that actually asking too many intrusive questions about sex is now a bit of a subconscious issue for people in your line of work, because you think, oh, I don't want to fulfill people's cliched expectations.
That's right. I mean, things have changed a lot, but some of the early analysts, you know, the early 20th century, would ask people very direct questions about their sexuality and their sexual practices. But nowadays, very, very few people do that unless they're actually sex therapists or working in a related field. So if someone comes to a session and says, you know, they had a sexual encounter the previous night, we might well ask, you know, tell us about it. What did you feel? What was it like? What were you thinking about? What were you feeling? All this. But we're not going to say, what positions did you do? Where did you touch the other person? Where didn't you touch them? Because that would be weird and intrusive. And it would obviously make people, you know, paranoid if they think every aspect of their private life is going to be examined in such a harsh way. So we don't ask those questions, which is great. It allows the person to talk about what they want to talk about, what they feel is important. But on the other hand, the folks that do ask that kind of question, like the sex therapists and people that do research into sexuality, have found out a lot of amazing stuff that most analysts, and certainly myself, were just not aware of. So what I tried to do in the book was to bring those two fields together, to bring together what I learned from my practice, which is limited, and what other people learn who ask the more direct questions. And so there's a lot of information, a lot of very interesting aspects of historical and contemporary sexuality that can be linked to the therapies today, which I think, you know, is very helpful, not just in terms of understanding how people work, but it can also be very helpful therapeutically.
So to be clear, like a sex therapist today would be someone who was working with a client who, you know, actually had an issue, a specific issue around sex, their sex life, or their sexual taste, or whatever. In what you do, you know, you're not necessarily speaking to people who specifically feel as if they've got an issue around sex. However, insight to their sex life or their ideas or feelings about sex is useful and revealing. With regards to other areas of their inner life, right?
So
if you don't ask them about, so you might not say, if I was sitting with you, you might not ask me what position or what any of the details about the sex I've had the night before. But if I told you anyway, would that would be useful information to you?
Yeah, and it would become part of the conversation, of course. But what's interesting is that perhaps because of the way that culturally analysts are always supposed to be obsessed with sex, in a way that makes us even less likely to ask about it. So maybe we ask less and less the kind of questions that were asked, you know, 100 years ago, whereas the therapists that do ask that kind of question are learning a lot of stuff that, sadly, we're not learning about in our field. So it's really interesting to put all that together and see what emerges from that. Occasionally, someone will come to psychotherapy specifically with a sexual problem, but it's quite rare.
So is it ever just sex? What do you mean by that question as your title?
So a lot of people use that kind of vocabulary when they talk about sex. They'll say, oh, it was just sex. It didn't mean anything. And the more you hear that, and you hear it a lot, the more you realize that actually, doesn't that suggest that meaning is quite important to the whole issue of sexuality? And when people talk about sexual relationships, the highs and lows, the heartaches, and the pleasures that they might experience, you find really quite pervasively that meaning and emotion, which is obviously linked to meaning, are central to the whole business. Now, when you look at the scientific studies of sex or pornography, they tend to ignore those questions of meaning. So in a way, the scientific studies and the pornography share the same approach, that they see sex as a kind of physical operation that doesn't involve meaning. Yet I would imagine that most people, if not everyone, that's engaged in some kind of sexual life will recognize how important meaning is to the whole thing and at every level.
I sort of
grew up in a sort of a laddish culture, and I even worked on things like Lad Mags when I was in my 20s, and even before that, growing up, I was always surrounded in a sort of a Jack the Lad kind of culture, in which sex was often referred to almost, you had to refer to it as if it was meaningless. You had to refer to it as, in the sense of it being conquest, in a sense of it being entirely just hedonistic fun, right? Yeah. And there was, and in that era in the 90s as well, there was sort of a lot of women began to speak about it in the same way. And that just seemed to be the prevailing way in which sex was thought and spoken about. And yet inside, I never really felt about it that way. I always felt, actually, sex is a massive deal. It's not a small deal. It's a huge deal. That's how I always thought about it. And I think loads of people did, but we're going along with this other way of thinking and speaking about it. And now I sort of think, you know, the world that my kids are growing up in, where pornography is so prevalent, that must be even more extreme. So in what way is that tangled up in, you know, what people call the mental health crisis that we now live in, and the amount of anxiety we feel, and issues with self-esteem and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, things have certainly changed a lot in some respects since the mid-90s. There's the whole, you know, questioning around gender and identity and sex roles that people take or not. The lad culture is still, you know, very present in many parts of society, absolutely. But I think, you know, more and more young people have a more sophisticated vocabulary to talk about sex, thanks in part to education programs in schools. But we've got to remember that sex starts out in life. Our first encounters with it are as something that is deemed wrong or bad or in between the lines, something that can't be said really, even in our, you know, enlightened liberal times. You know, parents tend to tell children what not to do with their body rather than what to do. You know, they don't encourage their children to masturbate, for example. They tend to turn questions about sex into questions about reproduction or questions about love. And although that might have some benefits, it also has some pitfalls. And it means that children are always on the lookout for what isn't being said directly. And there's a lovely example of that in that Monty Python film, The Meaning of Life, where in their sex education class, the teacher and his wife actually have sex in front of the class, and they're all looking out of the window. They're not interested because everyone knows that if something is said directly and clearly, that isn't what it's really about.
Yeah,
it's something that has to be teased out, learned through, you know, what you don't quite understand, what's opaque, what you can't quite grasp. So there'll always be that dimension. So however good sex education programs are, there'll always be that margin of what isn't communicated. And that's where often the peer group steps in, you know, cultural pressures about how you should behave, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, with who, and so on. So there'll always be a lot of pressures for young people. Today, with the internet, with, you know, porn being so much more available to youngsters, I think what's interesting is that, you know, we think because there's so much of it there, it's perhaps isn't really going to have any negative effects. And there's the long, very conservative tradition of, you know, anti-porn campaigners that no one really wants to be associated with today. And yet, at the same time, we often meet people, you know, in practice, clinically, who have been totally traumatized by stuff on the web that nothing has prepared them for and is extremely disturbing. You know, there's if you look at the kind of main searches on things like Pornhub, they nearly always involve forbidden, illegal, illicit activities that break familial boundaries. And you could say, well, that's just what porn is. It's about representing forbidden things, and that's why people get turned on. But at the same time, there's much more incest porn today than there used to be that's readily available for young people. And a lot of them are, you know, very, very disturbed by this. I'm not suggesting that, you know, all this stuff has to be sanitized. I think the perspective to take is perhaps to recognize that any encounter with sexuality as one grows up is going to be traumatic, that sexuality is something that is stronger than we are. It overpowers us, it possesses us. So there'll always be some traumatic dimension to sexuality, but that doesn't mean that we can't recognize particular problems today in the way, for example, that young people encounter certain kinds of pornography.
So you're not, so you're saying people want to distance themselves from that conservative tradition. I've always considered myself, or like to think of myself, as like, you know, as opposed to the idea of conservatism with a big or a small C, as I'm able to be. And yet I, you know, pornography is something that really concerns me. And I think that all the things you're saying are like, you know, pornography does present a two-dimensional and often toxic portrayal of what sex and sexuality is. And that I can't see any good coming from it at all. And so, yeah, I mean, I mean, you sound, I'm surprised, but maybe I'm misreading it, that you sound, you know, fairly relaxed about the prevalence of it on the whole. Is it a matter of us sort of preparing young people, our children, more for what it is they might encounter and how they might interpret it, rather than trying to outlaw it completely?
Yeah. No, I'm not in favour of any kind of outlawing. I mean, I think that what's interesting is that there are lots and lots of efforts in the last 20 years to redo pornography so it's less toxic. What we can call parity porn, where there's more equality, where there's less violence, where there's more, you know, representations of consent. All these things are obviously of great importance. But what you don't find, as far as I know, is you don't find scenarios where someone says, oh, not now, or not you. In other words, where people take their prior attachment seriously. Because in real life, people choose to have sex or not to have sex depending on their loyalties and their attachments. So you might choose not to be with someone if you have a pre-existing commitment, or you might decide to do so, again, but always within the context of loyalties, attachments, or lack of attachments. So what would be perhaps more radical than the kind of current efforts to produce a new kind of porn would be a pornography where the characters sometimes decline sex and say, you know, not now, not you, I'd rather not.
Might not be, it might be a pretty short porno then.
Or a very long porno.
Just sitting around
until
waiting.
They meet someone that they're more comfortable to be with.
What is it? How should we be speaking? You know, what would be a more effective way for us to speak to or communicate about sex and sexuality to our children?
I mean, it's a difficult question, because the very fact that it comes from a parent or comes from a school will mean that it'll be able to have certain effects, but also it will not be able to have other effects. Because, you know, if something sexual is transmitted by a parent, you're not really brought up to hear that kind of stuff. You know, the last thing you want is for your parents to start talking about sex to you if you're a kid. So it's always been a problem for, you know, at least the last 120 years when people have been discussing this kind of thing. How do you talk about, you know, sexuality to kids? I think it's important to recognize that there'll always be an unpredictable, traumatic dimension to it. There's no perfect way. There's no entirely healthy way to do it. It's always going to be difficult. It's always going to have problems. There's no ideal way to do it. And of course, you know, kids turn to learn more about sex, not from their parents, but from their peer group. And there, of course, you've got, you know, fictions, myths, maybe some truths, you know, a lot of misogyny, a lot of, you know, disguised or not so disguised forms of hatred, exclusion, all the things you get in peer groups with adolescent kids. And that will no doubt have effects on sexuality. It's why the sexuality of youngsters is usually quite different from that of older people.
What about culturally? Is it different from, you know, here in the West or even here in Britain? Is this the idea of us being prudish and uptight about this thing in this country true, do you think? Yeah. Or is this just an issue like globally?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the British have always been prudish, but, and this has been noted by people on the continent for more than 150 years, almost 200 years now, journalists and writers on the continent in France, in Germany, in the Netherlands, for all that time have been amazed at the fact that British media includes so much detail about sex that just wouldn't appear in the media there. So if, let's say, there's a story about a sexual assault, if it's covered in, let's say, a newspaper like Le Monde in France, it'll say the allegation or the conviction, but it won't give you the details of what happened in the scene, whereas the British papers will. So there's this extraordinary contradiction that's been there for a long time and probably dates from a practice in this country that other countries didn't have called crime cons. This is a thing that started in the 18th century where newspapers would be specially printed with details of the alleged goings on behind divorce cases. So there'd be lots and lots of details of people's sexual practices. There's a kind of salacious literature. These things would appear, you know, every week, and people would read them, gossip about them, talk about them. So there's this long tradition of publishing publicly salacious details of people's sexual lives in this country, which we don't have so much in the history of other countries. So maybe that's culturally been a part of it.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's as a result of our prudishness, though? So we become extra excited about having details like that revealed, whereas, you know, laid-back Mediterranean countries can just shrug and see it as just being sort of a little bit infantile to get so excited about the details.
But I guess it's a question of what makes those details so important to some people. Is that proportional to the prudishness in the rest of culture, or do you see it the other way around? Is the prudishness in the rest of culture proportional to the presence of all the salacious details, the excitement? So I'm not sure what the right way to read that is, but it has always been noted, this kind of contradiction in British culture between the sort of the apparent prudishness and the, you know, the salaciousness in the media. But also in terms of sexual practice, I mean, this country was well known, much more so than other European countries, as being a center of child prostitution in the past. People would come here from other countries to access, you know, brothels that only dealt with, you know, child prostitution. And there have been, over the years, you know, many areas of London, like Marylebone and St John's Wood, which were specifically seen as areas for illicit sexual activity. So there's a long history of sex here, which is perhaps less known than other aspects of the national history here.
My dad lives in St John's Wood, and I never knew that. And now, now there's a lot of questions have been raised in my mind about his decision to move there.
When did you move it? So this is in the 1930s. If in the 1930s, you were a single woman and you said you lived in St John's Wood, that might strongly have implied at the time that you were being kept by a married man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was the kind of cultural connotation in the 1930s of a single woman living in St John's Wood. And before that, Marylebone was a centre of prostitution. 13,000 prostitutes in Marylebone at the end of the 19th century, according to some of the statistics.
Wow. I want to ask you about a story right at the very start of your book about a city trader who set himself goals every month. And if he didn't hit them, he would always respond in the same way. And part of that would be to meet a stranger via an app and go and have kind of emotionless, functional sex. And I was interested in that, as you know, from my perspective as a recovering addict, because reading it, I know you go on to analyze it in a number of different ways. To me, when I just read it, I thought, well, yeah, that kind of, it's not something I've done, but it sort of seems to make sense to me in terms of, distracting, numbing, sort of oblivion, doing something that's mindless and just sensory, same as how I might have used drugs or alcohol at one point in my life. But also the things I guess it was trying to combat were like maybe shame or sense of failure, which are two of the big, because this is mainly about men and mental health, this podcast, two of the biggest themes that seem to come up again and again and again is shame and failure. And those seem to be the big troubling feelings for men from all different backgrounds. But tell us a bit. I mean, that was how I responded to that. Sorry, it was actually really powerful to me. Tell us a bit about, you know, why you chose that story to open the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question as well. The I chose that to open the book because it seemed such a clear example of sex not being the result of some kind of, you know, reproductive instinct. It wasn't something, you know, that seemed to be kind of programmed into human life, but it seemed much more like, you know, as you said, a way to numb another feeling, a kind of self-medicating activity. And it showed very clearly that what seems to be sex isn't just sex. You know, when the guy was in a way compelled to have those sexual encounters, he was obviously doing it as a way of treating, of self-medicating pain that was linked to another area of his life. And so if we then take that as a starting point, you realize that sex, although sometimes it might be linked to some the wish to reproduce, or sometimes linked to a kind of pursuit of pleasure or excitement, generally, it's much more complicated, and it does have that quality of trying to block out other emotions. And that's something that we find not just around sex itself, but also within sex, because there are lots and lots of practices when people actually do have sex that aim to numb other aspects of that experience. It's something I talk about in the last bit of the book. The way people touch each other, what actually happens in the concrete reality, the second-by-second reality of sex, a lot of things are going on which are there to dull sensitivity in other areas of one's body or one's mental experience. And when you then kind of put that in perspective and look at what arousal is, out of, you know, one very important early study, out of the 77 sources of sexual arousal, they found that only 13 of those could be conventionally classified as sexual. For example, seeing another human being that you were attracted to. Most of the other causes were linked to shame, fear, pain, concern, dread, worry. So it's extraordinary when you actually take a step back, you see that maybe most of the time, you know, this isn't, you know, great news for people who are, you know, so-called sex positive, but it suggests that most of the time when people do sex, it's not such a pleasure-focused activity, and rather it's a way of treating a lot of other complex emotions, things that we might need to avoid or we don't want to think through. And it's interesting to note that a lot of the words used for sex, to fuck, to ream, to diddle, to swive, all the historical words, they mean at the same time to have sex, and they also mean to cheat, as if like you're just making a narrow escape from some kind of calamity, that you've managed to have sex and you've avoided something really bad from happening. And presumably that is part of what it's all about.
That's really interesting. It made me think of, you know, there was a film, wasn't there, a David Cronenberg film called Crash, about, you know, people. I mean, you'll know loads about this, but it was always fascinating to me that this phenomenon of people who find themselves in car crashes, trapped inside, and they start to masturbate, or if there's two of them, they might try to have sex. And that sort of ties in with what you're saying, I suppose, isn't it? It's like a release and a distraction from another sort of pain or fear.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question, and there's a lot of fascinating research in it. And in the book, I actually quote a case of someone who had their first orgasm when they were in a car, trapped in a car after an accident. And I guess there's a question there that should we see the sexual arousal, the orgasm, as a way of, you know, finding a solution to another very painful situation, or do we see it really as just a different way of experiencing anxiety and pain? And researchers on this have been quite divided. Some people think that we just misunderstand our feelings of anxiety as arousal. We label them arousal because we're not actually aware all the time what we're thinking, mm-hmm. what we're feeling. I know this is something that you've written about, that we can not be aware of what we're actually feeling. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we can interpret what we feel as arousal when actually it's something else. And sometimes it can be the other way around, that when we feel aroused, we might interpret that as actually meaning something else. So it's a complicated area.
I mean, I make gags all the time, as a lot of blokes do, about the amount that I used to, you know, masturbate when I was an adolescent, right? But I must admit, I have thought about how when I was like in a, you know, so I don't know, 13 or whatever, like I've written about how I used to eat a lot. I used to binge eat. I used to be in the house on my own and I'd be really bored and lonely. And often looking back, I now realize I was sort of pretty miserable and sometimes quite scared being in my house on my own, you know, like getting used to being in the house on your own when you're about 12 and you first left alone maybe for a day or whatever. And I've often linked my sort of habit of like just sitting in front of the telly, like almost like incessantly, like in a frenzy, eating things like chocolate biscuits and stuff, right? And I link that to the fact that later in life I became an alcoholic and a drug addict, right? Because it was the same sort of thing. I realize that now. But, you know, I look back and I think, well, that was around the time, that was your wanking heyday, 12, 13, 14, where you're just at it the whole time. And you look back and you joke with other lads and go, oh my God, you're obsessed with it when you first discover it. But in many ways, it's like, well, I didn't have access to drugs and really have much access to alcohol when I was that age. But there was one freeway in which you could sort of distract yourself very easily from all the other feelings. So listening to you talk now, I'm thinking, yeah, whether it was food or wanking, it was all the same as drinking or drugs later in life, right?
Yeah, I mean, the wanking is, again, a really fascinating thing that people are often embarrassed to talk about. And yet it seems so important to understand how people manage to do it, because it's quite a feat to be able to do it, to make a story in your head coincide with an orgasm. Some psychologists have said that that's as important a milestone in your development as learning how to write or learning how to tie your shoelaces, you know, which are both quite a big deal. How can you construct a story in your head where you actually come at the same moment as you do in the story?
The story reaches its conclusion. Yeah,
amazing. And that is a kind of amazing cognitive achievement, which deserves further study. So there's a lot of fascinating stuff.
It's like narrative mastery, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. but you could say that when kids learn how to masturbate, that also will allow them to be able to read books, because to enter into a fictional world, if you read a novel.
Yeah,
you often, you know, you imagine yourself in the place of a character. Now, how do we learn to do that? Now, some people have argued that we learn that through learning how to masturbate. Yeah. We learn how to be someone else, or how to occupy a place in a story. So, you know, it is, I think, a big cognitive milestone.
Well, maybe there's people who are more skilled at masturbation. Maybe people who have more vivid imaginations or a better, you know, perhaps writers, for example, are more skilled at it. I'm sure I heard you somewhere say that, you know, some of the stuff you unearthed from speaking to sex therapists is that, a surprisingly large number of people admit to not actually having an orgasm when they masturbate. Maybe they can't get the narrative right in their head.
That's what Freud said. Freud said the real problem about masturbating is knowing how to do it well. But with your your memories of masturbating and then going to the fridge and getting your cookies and stuff. Yeah. I mean, the big question now is, I don't know if you've seen the TV ads for the new LG fridge.
No.
Where you touch the fridge and the door of the fridge becomes transparent and you can suddenly see what's inside.
Oh my God.
Now, this is either the best idea that's ever occurred to a fridge engineer, or or it's a bad idea. It's either going to be huge or it's going to fail. Because when most people go to the fridge, they open it not because they're hungry, but because they want an idea. They want something to stimulate them from the outside. A lot of people will go to the fridge maybe like 100 times in a day, just open the door, look inside, then close the door. So the big question is now, you know, is it going to be enough just to see through the door?
Are you going to still need well, it's to less fun. It? It's less fun because there's a sort of a nice surprise, isn't there, to open in the fridge door.
So let's say we could predict that it's not going to work. But anyway, let's see.
Yeah.
You do a podcast in a year about whether the new LG fridge has failed or not.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I'm right there for a fridge podcast, definitely. especially if we can somehow link it to our sexual habits or tastes as well. What, you know, you've got a well-deserved reputation, Darian, for writing about, you know, sometimes quite, often very complex psychoanalytical ideas in a very, accessible way. You know, your new book, Is It Ever Just Sex? I suppose, you know, some people are going to be really drawn to it. And, generally speaking, I'd say it's a great idea to have the word sex in any title of a book. But, of course, other people might find that intimidating, or they might think it's not for them. They don't have an issue with sex. So what would you say to people about what this book might help them understand?
Well, I hope it'll make people think more, ask more questions about what we're thinking about when we think about sex and what we're doing when we're actually doing sex. Because it seems, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there which needs to be thought about more, especially, you know, in the current world where all the stuff is supposed to be so transparent and obvious and available and accessible. And yet, you know, we see, you know, every minute of the day, the pain and heartache that problems in sex, that misadventures, that failed romances, all these things cause. So it's about trying to get a perspective on what place sex has in our physical and in our mental lives, and really just to get people thinking more and to ask some questions about, you know, what's going on.
My last thought about that is, with other areas of mental health, what I believe has really helped is that it's become so much more of a normalized conversation to talk to people, even people sometimes, you know, you don't even know particularly well. You know, even in comparison to 10 years ago, you might feel able to sort of reference your own sense of anxiety or reference the period that you might have suffered of depression quite early on in a conversation. And you might get something back from that person, and an exchange has happened, which you might find useful, because exchanges of experiences are just so helpful and powerful. Sex conversations, I would say we're nowhere near that, you know. I mean, sex conversations still, the only environment outside, I guess, of my marriage in which you can talk about sex in a sort of fairly open way for me would be sometimes, although less so now I'm older, but, you know, amongst a bunch of blokes, male friends. But that kind of conversation is going to be largely contrived. It's going to be full of lies and bullshit and posturing, because that's how guys often communicate about sex. And even if you are being honest, you won't often get a diverse range of experiences or you know, to share with one another. Sexual conversations, I mean, I can't imagine having a sexual conversation that is open and honest with work colleagues, relatives, female friends in particular, because with female friends, there would always be a connotation to that. I would personally think, culturally, if you start talking to a platonic friend who is a female about sexual experience, there will be an inference there that you're trying to, you know, start something. You're trying to.
That's the irony, because it's been recognized for a long time that talking about sex in itself has a sexual quality.
It does.
So, but one of the great things today is that there are a lot of resources on the internet where people can go learn about things, read about things, you know, have some kind of engagement with other people that doesn't necessarily involve a one-to-one in-person conversation, which might, you know, feel too threatening or too invasive for the person. So, you know, there are plenty of resources out there, but I think, you know, there will always be that quality of sexualization when people talk about sex. I think it's inevitable.
Yeah. So, but you're saying it doesn't really matter if we don't. It's not like you're saying it would be good if we all work towards it. Because I'm not sure. No. I mean, I'm a pretty open bloke, but I'm not sure I can envisage myself ever arriving at that stage.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to encourage that.
Right, Darian. I really appreciate your time. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, talking
great to
you,
talk to you,
and a real privilege. And the book's out now. I will put a link to it in the show notes with this podcast. It's called "Is It Ever Just Sex?" and it's wonderful. Darian, thanks so much.
Great, thank you so much. Bye, Sam. Take care.
That was Darian Leader, one of the country's most well-respected psychoanalysts, and a good bloke too, with some thoughts on hanky-panky that will no doubt have got you thinking. They did me. You can find a link to buy his book, Is It Ever Just Sex?, in the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening as always, and please remember to subscribe to The Reset if you don't already at samdelaney.substack.com. Until next time, gang, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.